we made it to a Thursday here on Main Street. I'm Craig Blumenschein. Welcome to today's show. Coming up a little bit later today, we'll venture off the beaten path with Chuck Lura to explore petrified forest, burning coal seams, and Badlands beauty. Then Dave Thompson and I will break down this week's top news from around North Dakota. And later, Matt Olean reviews the movie Eddington, a pandemic-era Western that spirals into chaos. Matt will also weigh in on the streaming success of Happy Gilmore 2. And we begin Main Street today with a discussion as to what happened on July 18th at the Minot State Fair during a planned B-52 flyover at the North Dakota State Fair. A SkyWest commercial jet on approach to Minot nearly collided with the bomber, prompting the airline pilot to perform a sudden go-around maneuver to avoid disaster. The incident, which was caught on video by a concert goer, is now under investigation by the FAA, the Air Force, and the airline, and the pilot spoke to his passengers about the event. And before I introduce our guest, let's play that audio.
For those of you on the right-hand side, you probably saw the airplane kind of sort of coming at us. Nobody told us about it, and so we continued, and air traffic, there's no radar here, so the tower is controlled, the tower does everything visually, and so they said report about six miles from the airport. So we did that. I think he realized that the spacing wasn't going to work, and he said, turn right. And I looked over, and there was an airplane, which those of you on the right-hand side. I thought it was a small airplane like the one you see at the airport right now doing touch-and-goes. And he said, turn right. I said, there's an airplane over there. And he says, turn left. And then by the time we read back the clearance, looked over and saw the airplane that was kind of coming on in converging course with us. So given his speed, it was a military, I don't know how fast they were going, but they were a lot faster than us. I felt it was the safest thing to do to turn behind it. So sorry about the aggressive maneuver, and it caught me by surprise. This is not normal at all. I don't know why they didn't give us a heads up, because the Air Force base does have radar, and nobody said, hey, there's also a B-52 in the pattern. Long story short, it was not fun, but I do apologize for it, and thank you for understanding. It was not a fun day at work. Have a nice evening, and I'm glad you're here.
And now let's bring in our guest, Dr. Jim Higgins. He's from the University of North Dakota, where his research focuses on statistical analysis, forecasting, safety data analysis, and operations research. Dr. Higgins, welcome back to Main Street.
Thanks for having me back on, Craig.
Jim, what are the typical procedures for coordinating military flyovers like this with nearby civilian air traffic, especially at a small or regional airport like Minot?
Yes, well, this was certainly not a typical event, right? It was a one-time event, or I guess an annual event. And what happens is whenever there's some kind of an activity like that, you know, anyone, event organizers, can make a call to either the local Air Force base or to the Department of Defense and request, you know, a public relations flyover. In this case, there's a B-52 base in Minot. So the call was made for a flyover. And of course, you know, it's something that is what we would call a crowd pleaser. Everyone likes to see, you know, our aviation assets flying over. It is a little bit unusual. It's what we call an atypical operation because it's not something that happens all the time. And so as a consequence, sometimes people, it's just not something that you would expect to see every day. Certainly if you're on board the regional jetliner flying into Minot, something those pilots didn't expect to see that day either.
So you would expect, quite frankly, that they shouldn't have seen it at all. The pilot essentially admitted in the audio that we just heard that he didn't know. How should he have known?
Well, there is there's a notices to airmen system that publishes written guidance when there's, you know, things like that that are kind of out of the ordinary, when things are not in service, you know, along that nature. But normally in a situation like that, you would expect air traffic control to say, hey, be advised, there's an aircraft B-52 flying over, you know, whatever, the southern part of the city, you know, shouldn't be a factor, or I'll keep you advised, things like that. Of course, the best way to do any kind of traffic avoidance is to get both groups of pilots to see each other. It's what we call see and avoid. Very simple concept, but even to this day, with all of our technology, it's the best, most effective, most reliable method of keeping aircraft, you know, apart and separated safely.
When I first heard this story, what struck me is that Minot had not FAA employees in their tower, rather contractors. Who are these contracted controllers?
Well, there are a number of what we call non-federal control towers in the United States at different facilities, but these controllers are fully certified. They go through the same training that a federal air traffic control employee would go through as well. Sometimes they're, you know, retired or they've moved out of the federal sector. Sometimes they're retired military controllers, but they are definitely qualified, you know, to the federal level, passing the same tests as the regular controllers would.
So if they are contractors, it seems to me somebody hires them. Who hires them in this case?
Well, in the case of Minot, I'm not 100% sure. There are some companies out there around the country that will hire for contracts. Sometimes it's done locally as well. There'll be, you know, like a tower manager or some kind of management in place for that. But they do, you know, it's very prescribed. The rules are very, very strict. You know, you and I couldn't just show up tomorrow and say, hey, I'm your air traffic controller. We're going to have to be certified. We're going to have to go through a fair amount of training. And I know that this incident happened in an area where there was a non-federal control tower. But I can tell you that the statistics out there show that these non-federal control towers are not any more or less likely to be involved in any kind of a problem or an issue or a conflict.
Do you think this is a matter likely of miscommunication? And I should note, as it was noted earlier, this is still under investigation by the FAA. But is it likely a miscommunication between both pilots and controllers, or lack of communication? What do you perceive at this point?
Well, as you rightly point out, it is being investigated, and there will be a full brief on this. You know, they're going to interview everyone involved. They're going to pull all the available radar data. They're going to pull all the available air traffic control communication data, everything that they can, and they're going to have a full report and explanation of what happened. That being said, you know, it's always fun to speculate. Sometimes it gets us in trouble. Certainly, I think it was an irregular operation, something that, the SkyWest crew, you know, wasn't prepared for, wasn't notified of. Was it a miscommunication? It's possible. I do also want to add one other potential possibility. Having been a former airline pilot myself, I can tell you, seeing a B-52 flying in the sky, these are enormous aircraft. And when you don't expect to see one, and maybe it's pointed towards you, or it's, you know, a little closer than you've seen before, it's going to get your attention. It's possible that the crew was surprised because maybe they just didn't know that to expect that there. Saw this gigantic piece of metal heading towards them or heading near them. And maybe at that point decided, you know what, we better be safe than sorry and just kind of move away from it. And so it may not have even, I mean, this might surprise your listeners, it may not have even violated any preset rules. I mean, it's possible that the separation criteria that are, required were all complied with. It's just that in the interest of safety, one crew decided, you know, this looks a little different. I didn't know anything about it. So we're going to go ahead and egress the area. A go-around or a balk landing or a missed approach, these are very, very common maneuvers. All pilots practice them all the time. So it's not even really in and of itself, it's just a missed approach or a go-around or something like that. In and of itself is not anything to be concerned with. It's actually a normal maneuver that pilots practice all the time, just like turning, climbing, descending.
I was pleased to hear the pilot talk to his passengers about such a dramatic event. It must have been dramatic for the passengers, for sure. What was your assessment of his discussion and his demeanor? And it sure seems to me like he did the right thing.
Well, you know, it's an interesting conundrum because I can tell you as a former airline captain, and what we teach our students here at UND and what others teach in the industry is it's kind of like going to your doctor, and maybe it's after a complex procedure that you had done. You know, we don't always understand all the medical terminology. And so if the doctor goes into great detail about, medically what happened, we may not have the correct context always to process. Same thing in aviation. You know, sometimes people are like, well, we want all the information out there, but it may mean certain things to certain audiences. And so I think it's always good to give an explanation if you're the captain and say, you know, something unusual happened. Here's what happened. You know, how much information do you give out there to alleviate concern or to not create a national story when there didn't need to be one? Maybe there was. We'll see what the investigation says. I guess that's up to the individual person. I generally was probably a little more verbose than other airline captains. That being said, I don't know that I would have necessarily offered all of the details until I heard about the other side and what the others, you know, what they were seeing. And that's going to happen when the investigation comes out. But you know, what we can all be thankful for and grateful for is obviously nothing bad happened other than
certainly
people got scared, which,
yep,
which is bad. But that being said, you know, we're very grateful for that.
I wonder about the airports like Minot in this world where I think we're going to have more drones, more noise, if you will, in the air. Will there be more radars provided to these smaller airports and these smaller areas to maybe in the future help with incidents like this?
Well, drones in general bring up a whole host of issues for detection. And you know, we're seeing that obviously play out on a very much more dramatic and you know, very catastrophic level in Ukraine and Russia, but other battlefields. But in the civilian world, we do have similar issues, just not obviously in a wartime environment. And yes, we're going to see more and more capacity in the sky used, whether it's drone delivery, whether it's personal travel. You know, there's a lot of companies out there making, you know, self-flying cars, if you will, self-flying, you know, helicopters, things like that. And we're definitely going to see that. The skies, you know, 20, 30, 50 years from now are going to look very, very different than the skies today. I'm certainly not saying we're going to be to like a Star Wars level or a Star Wars city where you see all the flying things moving around. But I certainly think you're going to see a lot more. So yes, there has to be technology that is introduced along with this increase in traffic, whether it's UASs, more aircraft, et cetera. Absolutely, we have to put procedures and training in place to help mitigate any of the increased risk, you know, that goes along with that. We spend a lot of time at the University of North Dakota involved in federal research doing exactly that. I'm on a team of researchers here that work with other universities where we specifically are looking at how we keep small drones from getting too close to other operating aircraft, whether they be other drones or passenger aircraft or any aircraft. So it's going to be a long-studied problem, but it's going to be one that gets resolved, and you will absolutely see increased technology at training and policies.
Enjoying my conversation with our guest, Dr. Jim Higgins. He's from the University of North Dakota. His research focuses on statistical analysis, forecasting, safety data analysis, and operations. And we're talking about the July 18th near miss, I guess, is how you might categorize this, of a B-52 flying over the North Dakota State Fair. At about the same time, a SkyWest commercial jet was on approach to Minot. What's next in this investigation? What should we look for? And sometimes it seems like we just forget about stories like this until maybe an investigation is later comes our way. Is that kind of what might happen here?
Yeah, there will be a preliminary report that's typically delivered within 90 days, sometimes sooner, sometimes a little bit later. It really depends on who's leading the report. If it was the NTSB, they'll be a little quicker. If it's the local FAA that's doing it, they sometimes will be right at that 90 days, a little bit longer. The 90-day report will be very factual. It'll just, you know, it'll have things like information about the people flying, information about the aircraft, information about the weather, things of that nature. And then there'll be a much longer term report that comes out that'll involve, as I mentioned earlier, interviews with all the people involved, you know, any data that's available, whether it be radar data or even some aircraft data. You know, whatever the inspectors, investigators can find, they'll put it all together in what we call a fusion and try to get a complete picture of what happened. The whole purpose of doing these reports is to identify what we call accident precursors. And so they're going to try to identify things that went wrong that were precursors or potential precursors to an accident. And then, of course, once we have that information, the idea at least is, the theory is we can then mitigate those precursors and look for them in other places. And then, you know, do our best to lessen the risk associated with that.
Have you perceived any increase or decrease in the number of near miss incidents like this one was?
No, but I've noticed there's been an increase in some of the news media coverage of them, which is, we seem to kind of go in spurts a little bit. So, for instance, if you remember about a year and a half ago, there were a bunch of maintenance problems that were being picked up by the news media, where, like, you know, aircraft would land and a hubcap would roll off.
That happened again this week, by the way.
Did it? Okay.
Oh,
yeah.
My goodness, yes.
And so, okay. So I did an analysis of this about a year and a half ago when this was going on. And there's a database out there that the FAA keeps called a Service Difficulty Report database, SDR database. And carriers are supposed to, and they're required to, fill out reports whenever there's some kind of a service difficulty, which would, you know, include things like we're talking about here. And I can tell you that there was absolutely statistically not even a blip of an increase, but for whatever reason, a couple key stories got out there, and you know, the public always is fascinated, obviously, with aviation and potential aviation. I mean, there's, you know, television series about it because it just really captures our imagination. And so whenever there's a story out there like that, it can really, really be energized with a lot of people looking at that. I can say the same thing now. There's a group in Washington, D.C., includes industry, includes the FAA, includes academia, and they monitor data that comes in. All this data goes into a central repository. Like I said, it's fused, and they look for any trends industry-wide, worldwide, and when they see an uptick, then they can move into different mitigations, and they can try to, you know, intercept something before it becomes a problem. I can tell you right now today, there has not been any statistical increase, anything significant at least, from the standpoint of, you know, is there some kind of an issue going on with midairs. There have been several news media reports lately. There was one out in L.A. the other day. A couple different things. I'm not trying to say these aren't important and these are things that shouldn't be investigated. They absolutely should. But sometimes it depends on, what captures the public's imagination, and it can create this perception that maybe there's some kind of a problem. And maybe there is, but I can tell you right now the data is showing that there isn't. But if there is, if there's a perception out there that is based on some type of reality, I can assure you our system out there is always on top of it, and there are people out there, safety professionals, that are every day looking at this, and they'll do everything they possibly can to prevent some kind of a catastrophe. And the proof is in the pudding. We obviously had an accident out in Washington, D.C. not too long ago, which was, you know, horrible, cost several people their lives. But before that, the last one we had was in 2008, and, you know, we haven't had one since. And so, you know, you still have a better chance of winning the Powerball, drawing the whatever it's up to now, 360 million, 370. You have a better chance of winning that than you do of dying on board a U.S. Air carrier, you know, in the next year.
Well, I know I'm never going to win the lottery, so those are pretty darn good statistics, if you ask me. My guest has been Dr. Jim Higgins from the University of North Dakota, where he is a professor in aviation. His research focuses on statistical analysis, forecasting, safety data analysis, and operations research. Dr. Higgins, again, it's a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us.
Always nice talking to you, Craig.
I'm Martha Barnett.
And I'm Grant Barrett.
And we are co-hosts of Away with Words. My background is in classical languages, and I never expected that I would be doing something every single day with ancient Greek, which is why I went into journalism. But this job combines both of those things in a really wonderful way.
I used to be a journalist as well, and an editor and an IT guy, but I've always had an interest in language, and I had an opportunity to join the American Dialect Society and eventually become an editor of dictionaries for Oxford University Press, where I specialized in new words and slang. So you bring Martha's classical stuff with my new novel stuff, and I think we'd kind of cover the gamut of what has happened and has happened in English.
I don't really think it's a challenge to make this topic interesting to people because we all speak language, we all share stories, and people are a lot more curious about this than they realize. They might think initially, oh, this show isn't going to be interesting.
Yeah, they think it's two stuffy grammarians with corduroy jackets and patches on their elbows, but we're not cobwebby old school marks. Join us every Saturday morning at 9 a.m. Central, 8 a.m. Mountain for Away with Words on member-supported Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Craig Blumenschein. While many visitors flock to Medora for its musical and scenic drives, Chuck Lura encourages explorers to dig deeper, from the prehistoric petrified forest to the mysterious burning coal vein and the rare stands of ponderosa pines. The area offers a rich tapestry of geological and ecological wonders. Trails wind through it all, offering a front row view of mule deer, mountain bluebirds, wildflowers, and the dramatic beauty of the North Dakota Badlands. It's a call to get off the main road and reconnect with nature's quiet marvels, as we'll hear in this natural North Dakota essay.
Many North Dakotans make a point to visit Medora each summer. The town, Medora Musical, and of course Theodore Roosevelt National Park attract lots of visitors. But if you go, make a point to get off the beaten path a bit. The area has lots to offer, including the Petrified Forest, Burning Coal Vein, Ponderosa Pines, and the Mottahe Trail. There's much to explore within Theodore Roosevelt National Park, of course. One can take a drive through the park, and there are several trails of varying lengths where one can get up close and personal with the Badlands. Also within the park west of Medora off I-94 at exit 23 is the Petrified Forest. This area will take you back to a time when the area was subtropical and supported swamps and forested floodplains. Think Everglades or Okefenokee. Today this area supports one of the highest concentrations of petrified wood in the United States, including several stumps, some of which are over 10 feet in diameter. Around 30 miles south of Medora on East River Road is the Burning Coal Vein and adjacent Burning Coal Vein campground. Seams of lignite coal occasionally catch fire, and this one is a landmark. First observed by settlers in the 1880s, the coal seam could be observed smoldering and burning down in the cracks in the ground until the 1970s or perhaps the 1980s. The area was also known for supporting junipers with a columnar growth form. Gases released from the burning coal vein were thought to be the cause for the columnar growth form. However, the junipers are now in their normal growth form. Also in this vicinity are a few thousand acres of ponderosa pine, the northeastmost natural stand in the continent. The Mottahe Trail is a well-marked trail for hikers, bikers, and equestrians. It stretches from the CCC campground south of Watford City through the Theodore Roosevelt National Park South Unit down to the Burning Coal Vein campground. No motors allowed. Badlands flora and fauna abound, with good chances to see mule deer, antelope, mountain bluebirds, as well as a myriad of wildflowers. But the real draw is the spectacular scenery of the North Dakota Badlands. A hike or ride of any length should provide some spectacular scenery and wildlife observations. I've put several links to more information on these places along with a text of this natural North Dakota. You can access them at prairiepublic.org. I'm Chuck Lara.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center. You can get Natural North Dakota essays delivered to your inbox every week. Sign up for the email newsletter at prairiepublic.org.
Still to come on today's Main Street, Dave Thompson and I will break down the week's top news from around North Dakota. And later, Matt Olean reviews Eddington, a pandemic-era Western that spirals into chaos. And Matt will also weigh in on the streaming success of Happy Gilmore 2. That's all ahead on Main Street, right after this news. Since it's still Thursday in the Main Street studio, we continue Main Street with our weekly review of the news with our veteran news director, Dave Thompson, who joins us again. Dave, how are you?
I'm doing well, Craig, and you?
I'm doing well for the dog days of summer, and we have a lot to cover, starting with North Dakota's Doge effort. They held their first meeting, and here we go.
Here we go. This is North Dakota's version of Doge, which is actually really called the Legislative Task Force on Government Efficiency. Had its first meeting in Bismarck this week. Now, it's not like the federal DOGE effort because the legislature is in control and the legislature has not given up the power of the purse. Representative Nathan Tolman of Mandan introduced the bill in the 25th legislature. He chairs it, and he says his idea is we're going to find efficiencies within agencies, but they're not going to come in with a sledgehammer approach or a, you know, let's tear things down. He says our plan is not necessarily to cut people just to cut people. We want to make sure everything's done right, but maybe find some efficiencies.
Do you have a feel for which departments might be under the most scrutiny right now?
Right now, I think you can take a look at Health and Human Services because it's combined. You know, health and it was a separate health department and then combined with Human Services, and that was done a few years ago. Now they're taking a look at it, seeing if there's ways that they can maybe do less, but do it well. I know I've heard that. The other thing might be commerce. And the third one that they were looking at this week, that IT was looked at too. And, you know, IT is really, you know, a lot of spending because computers are expensive and maintaining computers is expensive. But they're looking for ways maybe they can do something a little bit different.
And maybe they can do something a little bit different. I know Wyoming went down this road, Dave, years ago. One recommendation that would have saved a lot of money was that the legislature decided that every school district in Wyoming has an accounts payable person, an accounts receivable person, and a payroll department. Well, let's just make four regional centers to handle those school administrative tasks. Some folks thought it was a good idea, except the local district said, no, not in my school district.
And I know there's been some discussion about doing some more consolidation in higher education, especially to have, you know, not every institution has a president. That's been talked about for years, but really the institutions are different institutions. They all have a different mission.
Let's move on. The Industrial Commission heard a proposal for a new natural gas pipeline to bring Bakken gas to the center and eastern parts of the state.
Right. This is something that needs a little bit of explanation, Craig. The reason why is there's a demand for natural gas. Some areas in central and eastern North Dakota don't have access to natural gas. Secondly, the Bakken is producing gas, and this is this gas-oil ratio, the ratio they talk about. As oil production goes down, natural gas goes up. And the worry is that because we have some limits on flaring, we need a place for that natural gas to go, or they're going to shut oil production back a bit. And nobody really wants that because oil and gas are pretty big drivers of revenue in North Dakota right now. So the idea is to make these pipelines that will bring natural gas from western North Dakota to the Bakken into a Fargo, Grand Forks, Wahpeton. And now you're taking a look at data centers where you can use it for power generation. There's a lot of things happening there, and there are two companies, WBI, which is a subsidiary of MDU, and another company that had some experience as Highland and now has a different name, and they're proposing pretty good-sized pipelines with a lot of gas.
Dave, you've made the remark that I want to explore a little bit more, that there's more coordination between renewable energy and coal-fired plants in North Dakota.
That's right. Now, it's been interesting because everybody's talking about grid reliability. And we have two regional transmission organizations that serve the state. You got the Western Area Power Administration, the Southwest Power Pool. Well, when times where we've got cold weather and the wind isn't blowing, well, wind power is not going to foot the bill. So they've decided that they need this dispatchable power. So North Dakota has been slow walking, closing down coal-fired plants. So that's a plus, they say, for North Dakota because, hey, these coal plants will provide the electricity. There are some environmental concerns, of course, but, you know, coal companies have put a lot of money into scrubbers and things like that to get more of the carbon dioxide out of the air.
Earlier in the year, North Dakota had the highest positive measles rates in the country, but now infection rates have slowed.
As more and more publicity from media and from other sources has taken place about measles, kids are getting more vaccinations now. They're getting into it, so they're not, you know, not as susceptible to measles. And a lot of the measles cases were coming from out of state. So, you know, they were flying into Williston, they were flying into Dickinson, Bismarck, Mandan. And it really seemed like that's, you know, more of a, shall we say, on the wane at this point.
Yes, let's hope so. A little known, Dave, property tax exemption is making the news here in the Fargo area. It can allow daycare centers, and when you think about it, daycare centers need a lot of help, to not have to pay property taxes.
And what they want to do is get the message out. You don't have to pay property taxes. Might incentivize some people to set up some daycares, because daycare continues to be an issue in North Dakota.
Dave, there are some questions now relative to the availability of good rural health care in North Dakota, but rural health care providers are feeling federal funding cuts. This is a serious story.
Now, the administrator of Western Plains Public Health says the budget options are not very plentiful. They're making adjustments. They're trimming costs. They're raising fees. But, you know, a lot of the federal money has dried up, and they're just kind of worried about it at this point. Now, Craig, just as one other thing, you've heard about the Diversion Center in Fargo. There was a plan to do one in Bismarck, but federal funds have kind of dried up for that too. So I'm going to be looking into that one, see what the future is for a Diversion Center in Bismarck.
Dave, we can now put the pedal to the metal, so to speak. Starting tomorrow, new speed limits take place on interstates in North Dakota, and 80 miles an hour will be the standard for much of the state.
Well, what's new there is that it's 75 to 80, but there are going to be certain areas of the state where you will not be, you know, they'll put a little bit lower speed limit sign on it. For example, if you go through the Badlands, because it's very windy, they were going to lower that to 70 miles per hour. In Bismarck, Mandan, and Fargo, Moorhead, in Jamestown, Valley City, and Dickinson, they're going to lower it to 65 because you're going through more of an urban area and there's more traffic there. But otherwise, if you're driving between Bismarck and Fargo and you're on the interstate and you're right around Medina, you can go 80 miles an hour. And they have also raised speeding fines in construction zones, which they haven't done in a while, too. But still, North Dakota's speeding fines are pretty low compared to other states.
Dave, what are you and the news team here at Prairie Public working on?
Well, as I mentioned about some of those things, but I really want to take a look, make a more deep dive into what is exempt from property taxes, other than things that we know churches are exempt, and certain nonprofits may be exempt. We're going to have to take a look at that as a newsroom and find out what is allowed under state law.
We enjoy our conversations each and every Thursday here on Main Street with our veteran news director, Dave Thompson. Dave, I hope you have a great weekend. It's promising to be a little nicer, and maybe all of that smoke will be blown out of the state. Let's hope so.
From your mouth to God's ears, Craig. Thank you so much.
Thanks for joining us here on Main Street.
Gather around, everybody. I'm gonna tell you a story about a little fella.
Trollwood Performing Arts School presents the 2025 Main Stage musical, Mamma Mia, July 22nd through 26th and July 29th through August 2nd at Blue Stem Center for the Arts, Moorhead, Minnesota. Ticket information at trollwood.org.
It's Thursday here in the Main Street studio. Our good friend Matt Olean makes his weekly appearance. Matt, how have you been?
I've been fine. How are you?
Summer's inching along now. Mm-hmm. We're heading towards fall, but we still have movies to review. This week's movie is Eddington. Let's play the trailer.
I am recording this. Fair warning.
Is that really necessary?
Look, Joe, 6 feet.
Where the buffalo roam.
Is that praying?
Where the deer and the antelope play.
Oh, how did we get here? And even worse, is it worth it?
Where seldom is.
At the cost of being at war with your neighbors?
The discouraging word.
That's why I'm running for mayor.
And the skies are not.
Mayor of Eddington. Thank you super duper very much. I used to think that you were some big deal, but I am a much better human being than you.
Who are you talking to? There's nobody here.
Home, home on the range.
Husband, sheriff,
mayor to be.
Where the deer and the antelope.
You want things simple and neat. We are in a fight against evil.
These are your streets.
No, they're your streets to reclaim.
You know how death works?
Yeah.
People are going to be looking here now.
Keep your own office going, but you're going to run mine.
So we'll vote Joe Cross, take back our community.
Hell yeah.
Save our soul.
Your pain is not a coincidence. You are not a coincidence. We
are not a coincidence.
Never just try it.
We need to free each other's hearts.
All right, our audience now has heard the trailer. This is a surreal dystopian Western, I guess,
with
a paranoid sheriff in the world of pandemic panic and political rivalry. What did you think of this film, Matt?
So when you said it's a dystopian Western, I think the main problem with this movie, directed by Ari Aster, now he is a pretty successful director. Midsommar is his masterpiece, which is this slow burn film with Florence Pugh that a lot of people have seen. And it is a borderline masterpiece, I think, in the horror genre, psychological horror. But since then, I think he hasn't really followed that up. Beau Is Afraid with Joaquin Phoenix did not hit with audiences. This opened at $4.3 million, which is under expectations. I've talked on this show for 20-plus years, Craig. If a film can't answer the question, what is this movie about? That's a problem. So is this a Western? Is it a treatise on COVID and the paranoia and the pitting of people against people in communities versus masks versus not wearing masks? Or is it a horror movie? What is it? And I don't think it can answer that question. And I think at times it's all three, but it goes off the deep end the last hour. The last hour completely goes off the rails. I can't get into too many plot points. Basically, the story is in this New Mexico town. So we go back to 2020, which now seems like 1,000 centuries ago, doesn't it sometimes? Like the masks and the distancing.
Sure,
And Pedro Pascal, who's underused in this movie. That's all I'm going to put out there. Emma Stone's in it too, barely in it. Pascal plays the mayor, Ted Garcia, running for re-election. He's a mask believer. He need to distance. He need to do all this. But he's also having city council meetings in his bar where people aren't wearing masks. And as you recall, Craig, wherever you were living at the time, if you were still in Riverton, this was a huge thing with school boards and city commissions. Hey, sure you guys aren't wearing your masks. What's going on? And yet you're telling us to wear masks. So this became a huge spark in communities, and that's what's going on here. Joaquin Phoenix is the sheriff, kind of this bumbling, stumbling, mumbling sheriff, and I'll get to that in a minute with his performance, who does not believe in masks. And so there's this standoff, and he decides to run for mayor against Ted Garcia, and that is when all hell breaks loose. And I think there's an interesting movie somewhere in here about COVID, about what was going on in this country in 2020 within civic communities, city commissions, school boards. I know people who went through this that served on commissions and school boards that kind of went through things like this. And it was a very difficult time to govern, as you remember, Craig. And I think there's a really interesting movie about that in here, but it completely goes off the rails the last hour. It becomes a gore fest, which, you know, with Ari Aster, you expect a twist at some point, especially with Midsommar. You know, where Florence Pugh goes over to Scandinavia and can't escape, basically, and weird things are happening. I think there's a really good movie in here. It just didn't stick the landing. That's another thing I've talked about for years on this review show. Can a film stick a landing? A lot of films can start good first half hour, good first hour. And I did. I was into it for the first hour, 20 minutes. My good friend who went with me, she said the same thing when it was over. What happened at the end? What's going on? There are things that happen in the last 15 minutes that just do not make sense plot-wise. We were scratching our heads. Like, what happened? What just happened? What's going on? You know,
So it's essentially the standoff of these two men, and eventually all hell's going to break loose. I will tell you, I'm hearing of walkouts at this movie across the country at certain spots. We didn't leave, of course. I never leave a movie. I can't do that as a reviewer. So I think half of it is really good, kind of an interesting commentary on the paranoia of the times during COVID. And some of it isn't. Austin Butler shows up as kind of this, who played Elvis a couple years ago. He shows up as kind of this out there soothsayer, cult leader, and he's kind of underused as well. Phoenix is the definitely lead character. Now, I like Joaquin Phoenix. He's an Oscar-winning actor. He's an interesting actor. He was great in The Master. He played Johnny Cash. I didn't like him as well in this movie, but sometimes I feel like he's too idiosyncratic, and 30% of the time, I could not understand what he was saying. You know, they used to complain in the old days about Brando mumbling. I could always understand Brando in movies. There's 30% of the time I'm saying, Ari Aster, can you have him re-record his dialogue? Because I can't understand it. And so that's a problem. He kind of plays this bumbling, stumbling, mumbling sheriff. That's what I'm going to say right there. And I guess that's how they wanted the part to be. And this sheriff is alternately kind of stupid, but also ambitious. And I can't really get into plot points of what's going on in his brain in this movie. But good first half. Last half goes off the rails.
All right, Matt, let's kind of turn the page a little bit before we get to our question relative to the Academy Awards that we ask every week. I want to ask you about Happy Gilmore 2. It's not a movie I think that you plan to review, but
even though I'm a golfer, right?
Yeah, yeah. It did open streaming on Netflix this past weekend. It's been out now for, what, about 5 days, 6 days here. So the question becomes this, Matt. Why wasn't it in movie theaters? And this movie now reportedly has 100 million streams. Jeez. How does that compare to the biggest blockbusters of the summer?
Well, if Superman opened at 115 million, which it did, that doesn't mean 115 million people went to the movies, because movies don't cost a dollar anymore.
Divide that by 10 at least.
Yeah, 10. So maybe 15 million went. So they must have a strategy at Netflix to determine that maybe the Happy Gilmore audience is a streaming audience. We've talked about this many times, Craig. Audience viewing has changed since COVID. We just talked about COVID, right, with Eddington?
Yep.
Another factor of COVID is people stop going to movies, unless it's the Barbenheimer weekend, unless it's Superman, unless it's a Marvel movie. So I don't know why it's not in theaters, except they must have determined a profit loss was better to come by with the streaming. You know, you have your golfer. I understand Rory McIlroy's in it, Jack Nicklaus, so I probably should see it.
Scotty Scheffler.
I was hoping for Lee Trevino to return. Maybe he doesn't, but John Daly's in it. So they got all kinds of people in there. I don't know. You'd think the golf crowd would be a crowd that maybe would go to theaters, but maybe not. So, you know, Netflix has proven time and time again they know what they're doing. Right, Craig? They know what they're doing. I remember Roma back in 2018, the film by Alfonso Cuarón, which won the Foreign Language Oscar. They decided to put it on Netflix, not in theaters. And it got the Oscar. And I don't think it's that good. I think it's overrated as heck. And had it gone in theaters, I can see like two people sitting at the Fargo Theater watching it. You know, but once it went to Netflix, people saw it. Oscar voters saw it. So it was a great strategy that worked for them. And obviously this is working for Happy Gilmore too. Maybe they do put it in theaters at some point. I don't know. But it's an interesting question. I can't quite answer it for you, except clearly they made the right call.
Freddie Couples is in it, Bryson DeChambeau, okay. And I'm missing some. There's just
some other major champions in there.
Let's go to our Academy Award question. We mentioned earlier Emma Stone. Of course, she was in the movie Eddington. She also won her first Oscar for La La Land.
Yep.
She won a second Oscar. What was the movie?
Poor Things in 2023.
And Matt, who won the Best Actor that year?
Cillian Murphy as Oppenheimer.
And of course, Oppenheimer won for Best Movie.
It did.
We've been to the movies with Matt Olean.
This is Bird Note. I'm Ade Ben Salahuddin, and in June of 2022, I worked as a volunteer research assistant on a tiny island off the coast of Maine with the National Audubon Seabird Institute. This was during peak hatch, the busiest time of the year at these breeding colonies. Common terns are the predominant species here, and thousands of them were emerging from their eggs. It's a very noisy place. But every once in a while, particularly in the evenings, the chorus would suddenly go dead silent as every adult tern dove over the rocky cliffs, deserting their young. Then, rising on air currents, they'd return. This strange behavior is called dreading, and it's not clear why terns do it. At first, I thought it was a response to a predator, but often, there's no threat to be seen. Some researchers have suggested it's a form of social bonding for the flock, to help them coordinate flight patterns for long-distance migratory journeys. Or maybe it's just for fun. If that's the case, it must be pretty entertaining, because terns will stop whatever they're doing to join the dread, even if that means their hungry chicks will have to wait a few extra seconds for dinner time. Learn more about dreading at birdnote.org. I'm Ade Ben Salahuddin.
This is Dakota Datebook for July 31st. The United States Postal Service is responsible for issuing postage stamps, and that includes choosing the subjects. In 1957, the process was open to the American public. The Postmaster General appoints members of the Citizens Stamp Advisory Committee. Members come from a broad span of public life, including art, science, education, history, sports, and politics. More than 30,000 suggestions come in every year. The committee meets four times a year to review submissions and decide on the finalists. Committee member Justin Bua says, "A lot of stuff comes across the table. We like to give a voice to what's relevant and going on in the world." The committee passes its recommendations to the Postmaster General, who makes the final decisions. In one unusual case, the public was invited to vote on the Elvis stamp, whether it should feature the younger or the older Elvis. The overwhelming winner was Young Elvis. The first day cover is an envelope with the postage stamp canceled on the stamp's first day of issue. A small piece of artwork called a cachet is often added to the envelope. First day covers are a mix of history, stamp collecting, and artwork, and they're prized among collectors. Abraham Lincoln has appeared on more United States postage stamps than any other individual. There have been more than 30 Lincoln stamps. The first was issued in 1865, commemorating his assassination. He appeared again in 1909 in honor of the 100th anniversary of his birth, and again in 2009 for the 200th. President Lincoln also appeared on a 3-cent stamp issued in 1932. After 26 years, the price increased to 4 cents, and the stamp was reissued. Charles R. Chickering of the Bureau of Engraving and Printing designed it. The Postal Service gave careful thought to the location for the official release of the stamp. Washington, D.C. was a logical choice, as was Lincoln's birthplace of Springfield, Illinois. But the final choice turned out to be Mandan, North Dakota, the site of Fort Abraham Lincoln. The stamp was released on this date in 1958. Today, you can purchase a mint condition 4-cent Lincoln stamp for the bargain price of $500, plus $4.51 for delivery. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Dr. Carol Butcher. I'm Errol Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting art programming here on Prairie Public.
Take five, we've been at it all night. Renee Rapp broke onto the scene at 19 when she starred in Mean Girls on Broadway. Now at 25, her career has been a rocket ride. Album deals, concert tours, and HBO series.
I think I was born to do this, and this was the only thing that I was going to do, but I also think that, like, that comes with a massive emotional burden.
Renee Rapp tells us about her new album, Bite Me, on the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
And that's a wrap for today's Main Street. We are deeply grateful that you've spent time with us. Tomorrow at 3 p.m. Central, it's The Middle with host Jeremy Hobson. Jeremy asks the question, is crime an issue where you live and what do you want done about it? And at 7 p.m., it's Science Friday with Ira Flatow. From all of us here at Prairie Public, we hope you have a great North Dakota weekend, and we'll see you again Monday right here on Main Street.